Hello and welcome to the European Respiratory Society podcast, a regular feature of the ERS Respiratory Channel. The topic of this podcast is towards a good asthma diagnosis in adults, recent guidelines from the European Respiratory Society. My name is Florence Schlage and I will be leading this discussion today. I'm currently head of clinics and associate professor at the University of Liège in Belgium. And I'm also the chair of Assembly 5.2 of the European Respiratory Society and a member of the European Respiratory Society Guidelines Working Group since 2019. Joining me in the discussion is Inigo Onyanguren-Arans and Omar Usmani. Inigo is currently an associate specialist physician at the pulmonology service at the Vall-d'Hebron University Hospital, combining clinical and research activity. His clinical activity focuses on the management of asthma and interstitial lung diseases. Omar is a well-known professor of respiratory medicine at Imperial College London and head of ERS Assembly 5 Airway Disease. He was also co-chair of the ERS Task Force on the Diagnosis of Asthma in Adults. So Omar and Inigo, how do you diagnose asthma in your clinical practice?
Well, I mean, Florence, I think we're all faced with a patient who will probably be expressing sort of typical symptoms of breathlessness and wheeze, cough, and possibly chest tightness as well. And then I think what we want to do is, well, we want to have an objective demonstration of airway caliber sort of fluctuation. And I think it very much depends upon what's available to us, both in primary and secondary care. Wouldn't you say so, Inigo?
Absolutely. As you already said, asthma diagnosis is often challenging, and well, there are many aspects related to asthma diagnosis that perhaps we take for granted, or that we think that have been coined in the guidelines with a solid scientific base, but it's surprising that the way we diagnose asthma depends on where we are. In fact, here in a university hospital in Spain, apart from airway excessive caliber fluctuation, we have been using FeNO for asthma diagnosis for a long time. And even we use the response to oral steroids when the FEV1-FEVC ratio is below 0.7. So, yeah, I mean, there are many, many aspects that we need to take into account at the time of making a proper asthma diagnosis. I don't know, Florence, if you have the same way of doing things in your side.
Yeah, Inigo, I fully agree with what you said. In our university hospital, we also start with a spirometry, followed if the airway obstruction is present by a bronchodilation reversibility testing. And if the initial spirometry fails to show obstruction, we go with a further test like PC20, for example.
One thing that came out of the task force was really the importance of doing spirometry and the fact that it really isn't utilized in some areas as much as it should be. And that's one really important message that we all felt to make in the task force, the importance of spirometry.
Yeah, absolutely, Omar. One of the most important things that have been emphasized in the guidelines is the problems related to the overdiagnosis of asthma, and regarding to this aspect, performing spirometry, especially in primary care and even in secondary care, and to make sure that there's a positive bronchodilator test is essential for making a proper asthma diagnosis and trying to make an objective finding apart from suggestive symptoms of asthma of the excessive airway caliber fluctuation, and spirometry is without doubt the first step to go with.
What also I learned from the guidelines is the importance to look at FEV1 on FVC ratio, and not 0.7, but already 0.75 could be suggestive of asthma in these patients.
So picking you up on that, Florence, why was 0.75 chosen?
So the 0.75 was chosen as the best cutoff point to predict the presence of asthma diagnosis according to bronchodilation or PC20.
Yeah. So Florence, it's not only difficult to diagnose asthma in patients already receiving inhaled corticosteroids, but also those with comorbidities. Can you sort of comment on that?
Yeah, indeed. You're right. I remember a patient sent to the clinic to phenotype or receive asthma. And she was receiving high doses of inhaled corticosteroids, long-acting beta-2 agonists, and long-acting antimuscarinic agents. And she was still complaining from wheezing crisis and symptoms despite that. And I must say that she was sent by a pulmonologist to phenotype her severe asthma for an eventual biologic. And looking at her medical record, she never had any asthma diagnosis before. And then her mother told me, I recorded the sound during the crisis. And she asked, do you want to listen to the audio? And of course I did it. And I was surprised because I suspected a laryngeal dysfunction. And I sent the patient to the ENT and he had a laryngeal dysfunction, a vocal cord dysfunction. So we decided to step down the treatment. And then we performed bronchodilation test and PC20, and she was negative. So it's really important to know that, especially in case of comorbidities, I think it's so, so important to make the correct diagnosis at the beginning before giving inhalation therapies.
Well, Florence, the underdiagnosis of asthma, it's a problem, but also the overdiagnosis, right? Maybe in primary care, the first aspect to take into account is that the spirometry is perhaps underused. But in secondary care also, maybe we take for granted long-term asthma diagnosis without making the tests that we should perform to be absolutely sure that the patient does have asthma and is already benefiting from these treatments. Since when we make a diagnosis of asthma and this diagnosis is not correct, we are missing the opportunity to perform the correct diagnosis of this patient and offering him or her the right treatment. And in the differential diagnosis, we do have potentially severe diseases such as cardiac diseases and ETC. So definitely these aspects need to be taken into account and to be very carefully looked at.
Yeah, I agree. And we know that up to 30% of the patient is overdiagnosis of asthma. And in those patients, we did a step down study and we found that when you decrease the dose of ICS, they are improving, yeah, because they have side effects due to the inhaled corticosteroids. So Inigo, you were in charge of the PICOR regarding the use of FeNO to diagnose asthma. And you remember, there has been a lot of discussions within our task force regarding this topic. So could you please tell us more about that?
Thank you, Florence. Well, the knowledge and evidence reflected in the final document, which is, I think, the scrupulous result of a comprehensive research work, probably does not allow the reader to perceive the intense discussions and, I have to say, the opposing views shared by the panel members regarding if FeNO is useful for asthma diagnosis or not. So, well, to be honest, as experienced and high-quality asthma researchers, the committee members had already strong beliefs about the utility of FeNO in clinical practice or about the lack of utility. So perhaps it is worth highlighting that there are other guidelines such as GINA that recommend not using FeNO for asthma diagnosis, unlike the final result of this guide. So in this sense, it was a fruitful systematic review and a meta-analysis related to this PICO question, which was, I think, worth answering. And interestingly, it was the subject or the PICO question with larger evidence in the literature in terms of accuracy studies. So yeah, it was kind of tricky to perform this analysis, but the final results were interesting. And as I said before, we take for granted that guidelines have been coined in objective evidences and perhaps like performing a good systematic review and meta-analysis, it is worth in these particular aspects. I don't know if you felt or lived the performance of this PICO in the same way as I did, Omar.
Yeah, Inigo, I mean, you pick up on an important point that when we undertook the systematic review, it was the one test that had the largest evidence base. And that was a surprise, actually, to maybe many of us when we were looking at all the tests. And I think that's an important point. And as you say, it was very meticulous and scrupulous when you're actually undertaking this review of the PICO. And then, Inigo, you also identified different threshold, and that's often a topic of debate when we come to many tests, but particularly with FeNO, compatible with a diagnosis of asthma with the presence of current symptoms. So could you just sort of comment on that?
Yeah, if we look at the accuracy of the test for performing an asthma diagnosis, well, there are different cutoffs, and the different cutoffs offer different characteristics. So a lower cutoff does present a higher sensitivity, and logically, if you take a higher cutoff, like 50 ppb, the sensitivity will go down, but the specificity will increase. So finally, we thought for our last recommendation that it was worth making sure that the cutoff that we were recommending was presenting a high specificity, so that if we have a patient with asthma-like symptoms and the FeNO is higher than 50, well, this patient probably suffers from asthma. Florence, I don't know if in Belgium, in your current practice, are you using FeNO for asthma diagnosis? Since, as I said, in the first part of the discussion, we've been using FeNO for a long time here, despite Gina does not recommend using.
I must say that when I have a patient with a high FeNO value, most of the time the bronchodilation test and the PC20 will be positive. But I must also add that this is a type 2 asthma, and I think we must be cautious with FeNO because it does not rule out non-type 2 asthma. But in case of very high value of FeNO, we often have positive bronchodilation test or PC20. But I always combine FeNO, bronchodilation test, and PC20. I never do FeNO alone until now.
Well, we do not perform FeNO alone. When we approach these patients, the spirometry plus the bronchodilator test is absolutely, without doubt, the first option. But FeNO deserves an opportunity from a pragmatic point of view, help us performing diagnosis, although this aspect has been clearly emphasized in the guideline. A low FeNO does not discard asthma. There's a blind spot regarding non-eosinophilic asthma. So you are absolutely right. Omar, what about the DTS and the NICE guidelines? They've been incorporating, or FeNO appears somewhere in your algorithm. I don't know if you wanted to underline anything about it.
Yes, I think picking up on all our points, the key is that no one test in isolation should be used. We have the patient, we have a classical history, and then it's our ability to access the tests. The tests are complementary in helping us with the diagnosis. And as you have said, and Florence, you use more than one test to help you achieve that. And I think, Florence, you also raised the important point that we have different phenotypes of patients with asthma, and we need to be also cognizant of that when we are in the pathway of diagnosing a patient with asthma or not.
Yes, indeed. The FeNO is a very good marker of type 2 asthma, but in case the FeNO is low, this does not rule out asthma.
Omar, in your clinical current practice, when do you use peak flow variability to diagnose asthma?
Peak flow variability was very interesting when we looked at it in the task force. So I think if we go to the evidence, as we found, there were 6 studies, and 3 were in primary care and 3 were in secondary care. And then, as you've commented on sensitivity and specificity, so here with peak flow variability, there was a very large range in the sensitivity from as low as 5% to as high as just over 93%. And the specificity was more in the sort of 75 to 100% range. Now, the task force collectively reviewed the evidence, and we actually said, as the primary test to make a diagnosis of asthma, it wasn't recommended. And really, this is based on sort of the low quality of evidence. Again, we have written in the document, it is about the accessibility to tests. So you can consider peak flow variability if no other lung function test is available, including spirometry. And we've all reinforced the importance of spirometry. And also it can be considered if you don't have bronchial challenge testing. And I know, Florence, you commented on that earlier as being important. And if you are to do peak flow, then it should be monitored over a 2-week period. And that's certainly what we do. And a variation of 20% is considered supportive of a diagnosis. But again, as we've just discussed with FeNO, that the peak flow variability of less than 20% doesn't rule out asthma. So we come back to ruling in and ruling out and using the tests together with the clinical history of the patient. But we did all comment that peak flow variability may be useful to support a diagnosis of occupational asthma. So I think that sort of summarizes the evidence base, but also how pragmatically peak flow variability can be used in IGO.
Yeah, I was surprised to find out that the adherence to performing peak flow at home it was very low along all the included studies.
Yeah, and I think this is the difficulty with peak flow variability. It's the adherence to performing the test. And we, when we looked at the literature, didn't we? We found several studies over the course of the last 20, 30 years using different approaches, comparing manual recording to digital recording, and really recognizing that actually performing this morning and evening for 14 days was not very straightforward, was not very adhered to by the patients. And that, therein lies the difficulty of a peak flow recording. Now, whether advances in the recent years of digital methods to engage patients to record and make it simpler and easier will improve, I think it is showing that patients engage more, but you do need that two-week recording.
Absolutely, yeah.
So talking then about the different tests, blood eosinophils and serum IgE, this was a PICO question. So tell us about blood eosinophils and serum IgE in the management of asthma and the diagnosis actually of asthma.
Well, it was pretty surprising for me to find out that the literature addressing the utility of blood eos or even IgE for asthma diagnosis is quite scarce. But in general terms, despite the specificity values being good for eosinophils above 6% or IgE above more or less 500, the sensitivity values were between 20 and 50%, which means that we won't get this finding, high blood eos or high IgE, in many patients with asthma. So in this sense, the guideline recommends not using these tests for diagnosing, but for phenotyping. Regarding IgE, moreover, the values may vary according to the population, seasonal manifestations, and coexistence of allergic rhinitis. IgE also declines with age. However, measuring total IgE and specific serum IgE may represent a useful approach to assess allergy in primary care. So we conclude that blood eos and the serum IgE, it's not useful for asthma diagnosis, but it's useful for phenotyping. And in this context, well, it's addressed in the diagnosis algorithm that the guidelines present as well.
I mean, that was really interesting. Again, we were thinking about simple tests that can be done, and a blood test is a simple test that can be done in primary care. But here, this simple test was, when you reviewed the evidence, was not helpful in diagnosing asthma. And I think what we need to point out here, and the three of us found this in our relevant PICOs, was we focused on diagnosis of asthma in this task force, and we didn't focus on phenotyping. And we found many studies that were having response to therapy, and we excluded those studies, didn't we, Inigo?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting looking at the evidence. Many papers have been addressed related to phenotyping asthma, and related to this aspect, there's a particular narrative addressing this question. It was not addressed as a PICO question. There's not a systematic review and meta-analysis, but it has been addressed as a narrative question where we also address the relevance of making a proper phenotyping, since these patients will be able to benefit from specific treatments in terms of not only biologics, but also from specific aspects about different inhalers such as steroids or LAMA or LABA.
And so, Florence, on a similar note about different tests, and one of the PICOs was on body plethysmography. Do you use body plethysmography in your patients with asthma along the pathway of diagnosing asthma?
The asthma clinic, during the first visit of a patient complaining from dyspnea, wheezing, cough, I nearly always perform a body plethysmography. And in case of signs of overtrapping, it might suggest that there is asthma underneath. We performed a search in the literature for this PICO on the body plethysmography and conductance and residual volume on total lung capacity ratio. And we found that in case of signs of air trapping with a residual volume on total lung capacity ratio upper than 130, it suggests that this might be useful to consider asthma diagnosis. And at least this elevated residual volume on total lung capacity ratio suggests hyperdistension as a consequence of a small airway dysfunction. So however, this test requires the patient collaboration, and sometimes it may induce anxiety when the patient is forced to breathe while the airflow is suppressed. So most of the time I use it, but sometimes it's not easy to perform it.
So Florence, despite the recommendation being not to perform body plethysmography or for doing a proper asthma diagnosis, in secondary care or in terms of university hospitals as well?
Yeah, we did not recommend to use body plethysmography for asthma diagnosis, but in case of elevated residual volume on total incapacity ratio, this might suggest that there is something there.
Omar, at the end of the guideline, there's a diagnostic algorithm which is related to the information facilitated in the PICO questions. Could you tell us something about that? How did you shape the algorithm and which is the interpretation?
Again, this is, I think, a very important output of the guideline and actually a figure that probably we should have on our laptops or mobile phones or stuck in the wall in the office, because it synthesizes all the work that we did. And we thought really hard and really carefully about this algorithm. And I think we all remember we had huge sheets of paper on the floor with pens, and everybody was crossing things and adding things and amalgamating all the input from all the task force members. And I think the driving force for this algorithm was what would we recommend in primary care collectively? And we had two prominent primary care physicians on our task force. And then what would we say is the point where primary care should refer the patient to secondary care if things were not clear? So we started off with this framework. And I think we then decided to understand the tests in this framework. So you've got a patient, they've got chronic episodic symptoms at the time of testing, and in primary care and secondary, but we would say spirometry is mandatory. And as Florence, you mentioned the ratio, and you mentioned the ratio of less than 0.75 or less than the lower limit of normal. So spirometry underlies really the algorithm. And then you have options in primary care with bronchodilator reversibility and here of 12% and an improvement in 200 mils. And then, as you've said, Inigo, we've got FeNO is greater than 50 parts per billion. We also commented that peak flow variability if the other tests are not available. So in the algorithm, we've actually ranked the tests following what the task force found in its systematic review. And then in secondary care, and Florence, you've commented on this bronchial challenge, very much which we felt was the gold standard using histamine or indeed using methacholine. And then, as you've mentioned, Inigo, blood eosinophils and total IgE. And as you've mentioned, Florence, residual volume over total lung capacity ratio. And these would complement the diagnosis of your patient, and they'd be highly suggestive if available, again, with the specificity. So I'd say it's a clean algorithm based on the evidence that we found to give confidence in primary care and also to give confidence in secondary care, superimposed on listening to your patient. And Florence, you gave a great example of somebody who had vocal cord dysfunction or laryngeal hypersensitivity, and they'd recorded their voice in the time of COVID. So it just really comes back to putting the patient center and then superimposing the test, but not forgetting the patient. And time again, we go back to the history always, don't we? Whenever we see the patient, when we just, you know, think actually something isn't right here. So that was the algorithm.
That's nice, Omar. We had already other diagnostic algorithms. So which are the strengths or the added value of this new algorithm?
The strength of the task force was that we had a patient as part of our task force. And at every step, we had the patient input. And certainly, again, as you have said, Inigo, the figure here cannot capture the discussions, but we've tried to incorporate that in the narrative. So this is a real strength. The second is that it was a systematic review based on very structured methodology, grade methodology. And again, we've described that and we've compared it to how other directives or other guidelines may have undertook their approach. It's like clinical trials. You always have to look at the population, don't you, to understand the output. Well, here, the population or the methodology we've shown and the outputs we have found, and they have been integrated into the algorithm and also into the document. So I think that's the second point. And then the third point was, how can we make this algorithm a pragmatic usable, not just another document that sits on the shelf and gathers dust. And I think these were the three driving forces. How can this be used in primary care, in secondary care, and give us that confidence in managing the diagnosis of the patient? And again, as you both mentioned, Florence and Inigo, cognizant of overdiagnosis, but cognizant actually of underdiagnosis as well, Inigo.
Thank you very much. That's super interesting.
I think there's one thing I'd say before we hand over back to you, Florence, is that for everybody who's listening to this podcast, if you have any thoughts, if you have any comments, by all means, just send them to us, because this is a living document. It'll evolve over time. Evidence will be gathered and accumulated in the coming years, and there may be further iterations of this. I mean, there was an iterative process over the last 3 years, but I think we'd all really welcome comments on this and also comments on its usability, I think, in everyday practice.
That would be nice, absolutely.
Thank you for joining us for the ERS podcast. I've enjoyed taking part in it. And thank you to Inigo and Omar for their contributions and insight on the topic.
Thank you, Florence, and thank you, Omar. It was a pleasure to share this discussion with you.
Thanks, Florence, and thanks, Inigo. It was great fun, and I think we're really proud, aren't we, of the task force and the guideline.
You can visit the ERS Respiratory Channel each month for more podcasts featuring discussions between experts on the latest hot topics in respiratory medicine.